were in many ways unconventional, perhaps, in their religious beliefs. They were not always well-versed in Sharia, that is, the religious law, or the Quran per se. Their communication with God is often more personal and direct, at least many who came into contact with the Turks on the steppes. In Asia Minor, there is therefore this reverence for a Hoxha, for a holy man who has a communication with divine. At the same time, in the fighting that had raged over Asia Minor in the course of the 11th and 12th centuries, Christian institutions had been severely disrupted. Now, the sultans in Konya, as just Muslim rulers, followed the Islamic traditions of respecting the Christians as dhimmi, that is, peoples of the book. Their prophet Isa, Jesus, was accepted in the Islamic tradition. The same was accorded to Jews, and they were not to be violated. But the fighting had been particularly violent, and the clashes between Byzantine armies and Turks, crusading armies and Turks, this led to a great disruption of the Greek Orthodox religious institutions. Monasteries were particularly targeted and sacked repeatedly in the 11th and 12th centuries. And I think instinctively, Turks understood that the monasteries were really the bastions of Christianity in Asia Minor. It was to monks and ascetics that most Christian peasants would turn to for intercession with God. The churches themselves, even if they were respected, many of the bishops decamped to Constantinople. Very good studies of the episcopacy, that is the senior prelates of the Orthodox Church, reveals that the Byzantine emperor and the patriarch in Constantinople recognize all these bishops of ancient cities of Asia Minor. Let us take, for instance, a city such as Koh Tiayam. There is a continual succession of bishops of Koh Tiayam through the whole of the 13th, 14th, 15th century, except Koh Tiayam is now Turkish Kutaya. The bishop doesn't bother to go out there. He simply holds the title but remains in Constantinople. And so many of the Greek churches fall under the control of priests who are not very literate, generally ignorant of scripture, and increasingly the Christian community over the course of the 12th and 13th centuries becomes more and more disoriented. Their Christianity becomes less and less important. Many of the rock-cut churches, which are today premier tourist sites in Asia Minor. There is a tradition of trying to argue that many of those rock-cut churches, and they have wonderful frescoes that are painted, were done by Christians in this period as part of the policy of the Sultan's toleration. Well, that's wrong, except for four churches. The last one is the St. George in the Peristrema Valley, probably finished around 1294. All of those churches were done before the Turks arrived. Therefore, the Christian spiritual life, in my opinion, certainly in the 13th century, was quite impoverished. That meant the Christian population was ideally suited for proselytizing by Sufi mystics. Foremost among them is one man. He is now today revered as the Mevlana. He's born in either 1206, 1207, in Iran, actually, in Balkh. He dies in 1273. His prime language of communication was Persian. His name at his birth was Jalal ud-Din, and he later becomes Jalal ud-Din Rumi, that is, the Jalal living in Rum, Asia Minor. His father was a Hoxha and teacher, and he came from a very, very fine and literate family. Rumi himself, we often refer to him as Rumi, was a poet of great power, and the family had fled Balkh because of the Mongol invasions. His father, Baha ud-Din Walid, took the family to Karaman, which is in southeastern Turkey today. It's the ancient city of Laranda. Then in 1228, they moved to Konya on the invitation of the Sultan. Rumi succeeds to the school of his father, and then in 1244 undergoes a remarkable conversion, a transformation in which he becomes ascetic. And he and his followers, who are now popularly known as dervishers, are mystics who make the decisive, they really make the decisive difference in the converting of the Christians. Rumi is convinced that the oneness of God is all important, and that God can be reached through poetry and through dancing, especially mystical dancing. This leads to the so-called whirling dervishers. And any of you who have ever seen that dancing can see that the dervisher is supposed to point to heaven, point to the ground. His body, in effect, becomes the vehicle for the communication of the divine with the mundane. Furthermore, Rumi and his followers were seen as great teachers and holy men who could conduct miracles. We have large numbers of stories written by his followers, particularly Yunus and others, in the generations after him, reporting these types of mystical conversions that were carried out among Christian populations. It is easy to miss how important these experiences were in winning over Christians. And the experience is incredibly personal and yet awesome at the same time. Personally, I've observed they're not Rumi's group. It's a different order. They are known as the Nashkibandi, or Mashkibendi, as the Turks would say. It's an order that emerged in the 13th and 14th century in Central Asia. And in 2010, I and a former student of mine went to the town of Mengel in eastern Turkey. That would be close to the current tourist attraction of Nimrut Dağ. And we happened to witness the prayers conducted by this order in their mosque. Furthermore, this was a what's called a summer mosque, in which the roof is rolled away at the evening prayer and the firmament comes into view. And when you stand in a situation like that, you're in the presence of earliest and purest Islam, praying directly to God. And you feel as if you are with early Arab and Turkish nomadic warriors, where they just throw a prayer rug on the ground and offer up their evening prayer. And each of the mystics there is in his own state, in his own prayer with God. He goes into his own trance, his own experience, and when he comes out of it, he's finished and he walks away. Very much, this is what prayer, dance, all of these means of communicating with the divine represented. And to the Christian populations, this was a very, very powerful image. They had not had bishops and monks for generations. And now these Sufi mystics came into their villages, came into their towns, offered a vision of the divine which had long been lacking. And steadily, as a result of this contact, the countrysides are won over. Turbeler, tekeler, that is the plural for turbe and teke, are constructed across the landscape. And by 1350, the population has decisively tipped. It's gone over to Muslim. It is completely Turkish-speaking. It is now an independent Islamic Turkish civilization. The political failure of Konya is a moot point, because by 1350, the Seljuk sultans had set in motion a transformation of this peninsula into a new Islamic land. And perhaps their greatest achievement was to patronize the Mevlana. And the Mevlana and his turbe, which is constructed after his death in 1273 in Konya, is today the most sacred city for Muslims in Turkey.
Lecture 25, The Sultans of Delhi.
In this lecture, I plan to look at the results of the conquests of northern India by Turkish nomadic warriors in the early 13th century. And this is a lecture that is parallel to what we just discussed on the Turkification and the Islamicization of Asia Minor. It requires us to look at some of the same features. That is, why did the sultans ruling at Delhi fail to forge a wider imperial unity? They ran into some of the same problems as the Sultans of Konya. On the other hand, what were their successes and what were the limitations in creating a Muslim civilization in India? And as I mentioned in passing in a previous lecture, sometimes the Muslim conquest of northern India in the 13th and 14th century is really compared to a military occupation rather than a real settlement. And we'll want to examine that question a bit at the end of this lecture. Well, that requires us to look at two aspects of Muslim India in the 13th and 14th century. First is the whole political success. The second will be the cultural and religious issues. Well, let's start with the year 1206 when Muhammad Ghori died. He had carried out some of the most successful campaigns against Hindu opponents ever. In 1192, I mentioned he won that decisive battle at Tarain, north of Delhi. That delivered him control of northern India, at least the Doab, the upper reaches of the Ganges, and the Punjab. He, however, was distracted by events in Central Asia, and to him, India was a source of revenues. And so he really entrusted the running of his conquest to his subordinate generals. These, again, were Mamluks. They were slave soldiers. And the most important of these fellows was a fellow by the name of Aibak. Actually, Aibak's full name is Qutb-ud-Din Aibak. He was commissioned with directing the conquests in northern India, especially after 1197, when Muhammad Ghori was really more involved in dealing with the Kari Kittians, and eventually the ramifications of the Mongol invasions, or what led to the Mongol invasions. He's clashing with the Shahs of Khorasan. So Aibak was essentially left on his own to direct various campaigns. Those campaigns in the 1190s saw the consolidation of a kingdom in and around Delhi with a much looser confederacy across the Indo-Gangic Plain. From the start, power rested in the hands of these nomadic steppe warriors plus slave soldiers. And in 1206, when Muhammad Ghori died, Aibak essentially became an independent ruler. He assumed the name Sultan, and he ruled for the next 4 years from Delhi and then transmitted power in his family. The Sultanate is often called the Slave Sultans of Delhi, and that's a bit deceptive. This is a false analogy to the Mamluk sultans of Egypt, who were also slave sultans. In Egypt, there was a consortium of the leadership of the different military regiments in the Mamluk army. They would decide who would be sultan, and they didn't pay attention to hereditary succession. Aibak, on the other hand, established a sultanate in which power was transmitted through the family. They just happened to be Mamluks in origin, and so the term slave sultans of Delhi is a bit deceptive. Furthermore, from the start, Aibak realized you couldn't just depend on tribal regiments and slave soldiers. There was the problem of obtaining horses, and he began to give out essentially endowments or fiefs. Ikta is the technical term, and these were handed out to muktis, to leaders, to commanders, who would then use this land to support military units that would in turn be the basis of power for the sultan. Some of these commanders were really quite independent. The Khalji family, for instance, and they will eventually come to displace the so-called slave sultans, that is the family of Aibak, they were given the commission to conquer Bengal. And the founder of that family, his name is Muhammad Khalji. The name comes from where they originated in back in Afghanistan. They overran the lower Ganges. He sacked the great Buddhist sanctuary at Nalanda and essentially finished the Pala kingdom in the Bengal, which was the only significant kingdom in India that was still supporting Buddhism. And so that family essentially carved out an independent operation. And this would be a problem repeatedly in dealing with subordinates, your muktis, that they could conquer a region in India that was so wealthy that it could support their own court and their own army, And a saying that comes down from the Mughal period is very relevant to the whole of the history of Muslim India. It's stated by the Rajputs in Rajasthan at their city of Udaipur in northern India, Udaipur is far from Delhi. That is, we might recognize the authority of the Sultan in Delhi when that phrase was coined. It was the Mughal Emperor. But what really goes on in our city has very little to do with what the Sultan in Delhi is concerned about. Nonetheless, Aibak set the basis for the political control of Delhi and the Doab. He's killed in a curious freak accident in that bizarre, you know, polo game that's played on the steps. And he is succeeded by his son-in-law. A man known by his Turkish name is Iltutmish. Iltutmish comes to the throne and he rules for a long time, from 1210 to 1236. He really isn't a slave sultan in the sense as the Mamluks. He, too, originated as a military commander as a very young boy. He had been sold into military service. But he owed his position to the throne because he had married the daughter of Aibak and was absolutely trusted. He proved a very, very able ruler. He extended the use of endowments. He campaigned prodigiously and extended the influence of the Delhi Sultanate across the Indo-Gangic Plain. Both he and his predecessor, Aibak, will be very important in construction of architecture to magnify the glory of this regime. Well, we'll be talking about that later. From the start, he was concerned about a succession because the state was potentially unstable. And again, I must stress that while you can draw a map showing the extent of Iltutmish's conquest, those conquests were really very tentative. The state still thought in terms of having a large area that it could raid, from which it could exact tribute. And in some ways, the Sultan of Delhi was not too different from a Hindu Raj who would perform the traditional progress of receiving submissions. And already in Iltutmish's reign, it is clear that in order to rule India successfully, you're going to have to start co-opting members of the Kshatriya caste, that is the warriors and princes, particularly the Rajputs, the Jats in northern India, later kingdoms down on the Deccan and even farther south, if any kind of meaningful political order is to be constructed. And therefore, you will have to come to terms with that Hindu ruling class, even though you might raid and dispossess them in some areas. On the other hand, the only way for this to work is to start building a wider network of alliances. This is something that the Seljuk Turks in Asia Minor never had to do. For them, it was a clear contest. Byzantines on one side, Turks on the other. Furthermore, you had to satisfy the Muktis, and they formed essentially a governing inner council of this sultanate. They're usually known as the 40. They could pass judgment on a whole bunch of issues, including the succession to the various fiefs. They were rewarded with an itka that would involve a governorship. It might involve the profits of some kind of concession or monopoly, but usually it was land. And this was the way to maintain a large standing army. In addition, Iltutmish was concerned about his family. He had several sons, especially his older son he didn't trust with good cause, and he groomed his daughter to succeed him. This is a remarkable event. In fact, as far as I know, it is the first time that a female will rule as sultan, not feminine sultana, but as sultan in her own right. The lady's name was Radya Beyum, again that Yamashak gay, and she came to the throne in 1236 when her father died. Now, she clearly was an able ruler. She wasn't a great ruler, but she was certainly above average and certainly light years ahead of the later sultans of the family that followed. She, however, violated a lot of social conventions, at least in a strictly Islamic context. For one, she liked riding elephants. She also put on the trousers of the steppes. She was a great equestrian. She knew how to fight. In some ways, scholars see her as not only just unconventional, but a woman who comes off the steps. That is, that tradition that you can already detect among the Scythians and Sarmatian, that women of high rank might end up ruling, they might actually end up being warrior princes. And so some would argue that the tradition is really a recovery of this older steppe nomadic tradition in India. Others might argue that in part it is influenced by the role that queens have played traditionally in India before the advent of the Muslims, that they could rule independently in some kingdoms, they could wield great power. Whatever the case might be, she did rule successfully down to 1240, and then she ran into difficulty. The Muktis, the governing body of the 40, they in effect carried out a coup. They staged more than a coup. They staged a full-scale rebellion. And there were rumors that the Sultan, that she had been consorting with one of her viziers of low origin. There were other rumors that she had dishonored various Muktis, their outrage. The religious community, the ulama, that is, the theologians of the Islamic madrasas, they too found her objectionable on a number of grounds. And so as a result, she faced very, very serious opposition and was eventually overthrown by a coalition of these Muktis. And part of the problem for her was not only that she was a woman, but she also represented a centralizing tendency of the court. She intended to rule through through her agents and to rein in the Muktis so they wouldn't become so independent. And the result was she was captured in a major battle. She and her new husband were seized. They were defeated outside of Delhi on October 12, 1240. And eventually she was executed. And the result was the dynasty deteriorated after that point. Radhya was followed by a succession of weak rulers until the family was overthrown by one of those Mukti families, the Khaljis, in Bengal. Now, her reign proved a turning point for several reasons. One was that the efforts of the dynasty to centralize and to bring in the independent commanders had failed. The Council of the 40 had essentially won by defeating her efforts to centralize the state. Second, that the two succeeding dynasties, the Khalji dynasty and then another dynasty that follows them, the Tuluk dynasty, in the late 13th and early 14th century, in each of those dynasties, the founders attempted to forge a wider unity by conquering regions to the south of Delhi, notably the northern districts of the Deccan and farther south. All of these efforts ultimately failed. The first family, the Khalji family, came to power in 1296, and they, the second sultan of that hereditary dynasty in Delhi, who was known by the name of Ala ad-Din Muhammad, he took it upon himself to direct major campaigns into southern India. And this is the first time that Muslim forces really crossed, really, I would say, this boundary line that runs along the river that essentially cuts northern India from southern India, including the Deccan in the far south. He was well served by a general who is actually a Hindu convert. His name is Malik Kafir or Kafur. He probably was a low-caste Hindu. He may have been captured in a war and enslaved. He had risen to high rank under the Khalji dynasty, and he commanded successive invasions into central and southern India. These resulted in destructions of major temple complexes, particularly very well-known temples of the Hosala kingdom. One of the great temples at Bellore, for instance, was attacked and sacked. The armies penetrated deep into southern India, into the Dravidian-speaking regions. There was the temples at Madurai were sacked. This is very, very far south in the Pandya kingdom. Furthermore, Muslim armies raged farther east. And again, targeting major temples that were known for their wealth, their pilgrimage, Yet these conquests failed to net Ala ad-Din territorial acquisitions because they were vast raids, they rounded up captives, they rounded up plunder, and then the Muslim armies retreated. This dynasty, too, ran into the same problem of trying to reconcile central control with the Mukhtis. And when the raids started to cease, that is, the plunder, the loot wasn't coming in, in 1320, the second dynasty of Delhi was overthrown, and it was overthrown by a new family, the Tughluq family. Muhammad Tughluq, the most prominent of this family, likewise conducted similar types of operations against various Hindu kingdoms. But ultimately, these efforts to bring the Hindu kingdoms to heel failed. It certainly enraged many of the Brahmins who saw their temples sacked. And above all, it led to the consolidation of southern India around the city of Hampi, where two brothers who were actually reputed to have initially submitted to the Sultan of Delhi, establishing a great Hindu kingdom that we know by the name of Vijaya Nagara, which essentially means victory city. And this kingdom in the mid-14th century, somewhere between 1335, 1345, there's now a reassessment over the time, consolidates and acts as a block, a check on further Muslim advance into central and southern India. It is, in effect, a reaction to the attacks by the sultans of Delhi. So by the middle of the 14th century, you have, in effect, a political standoff between Hindu kingdoms consolidated in central and southern India and these sultans of Delhi. And as I said, to some extent, the sultans of Delhi largely ruled by permission of their Mukhtis, that consortium of 40 that exercised a great deal of influence in policy and even at sometimes in selecting the sultan. Well, on the political scale, the sultans of Delhi are somewhat successful. They do retain their thrones. They do resist the Mongols, but that'll turn out more to be accidental. And they never quite have the prestige in the Islamic world for their military and political achievements as the Mamluks of Egypt, who in 1260 at Al-Anjalut will defeat the Mongols. None of the sultans of Delhi could claim that. Far from it. The Mongols will repeatedly ravage the Muslim cities of northern India from the 1220s on. On the other hand, the sultans of Delhi, just like their counterparts at Konya, carry out a very, very active building program. And that is seen in Delhi today. To some extent, the building program is to promote Islam, but it's also to promote their own position within the Islamic world. Their armies were not ethnic tribal armies as you had in Asia Minor. Many of their forces were mercenaries. They were a composite group of different tribes. They still depended on slave soldiers. They were terribly tied, very, very much dependent on the trade bringing in horses from Central Asia. And so in order to promote an image of imperial power, building programs were the way to go. And the buildings of the sultans of Delhi turned out for their period to be some of the largest buildings in the entire Islamic world. And they're a way of showing that Islamic power now rested in Delhi. If you go to Delhi today, you have to go south and you go to a region which is known as the Qutbid complex. That is named after Qutb Aladdin.